Good morning. Blessings to each one of you this morning. And yeah, I've enjoyed being here so far this morning. Kind of mixed feelings, I guess, as I stand here and I guess just realizing that lots of change is right around the corner. Not really around the corner anymore, actually, maybe. Just, it's pretty much here. So, several of you have already moved, and we have not moved yet, but Jason's, Sean's, Wes's, not sure, y'all are down. I think there are some more, too. And then Tony's. Tony's are here for their last regular service for quite some time as well. And I just wanted to, we can think of the sad part about it, but we can also think of the good part about it. We can praise the Lord that other works are being moved forward, and other works are, more people will hopefully hear about God and maybe, yeah, God's kingdom can be built and added to. I also wanted to just take this time to thank y'all, each of you, for the part that you've played in our lives, me and my family's lives, in the last several years, and especially through school, different things, I guess, that we've had to work together on, and I just really appreciate what you've contributed to our lives. So thank you very much. That kind of leads me to, I guess, what I have prepared to preach about this morning, and that is being strangers and pilgrims. So God has asked us to be a people of a stranger in a place where we might not always fit well. We might not always be the same as other people. We have a different goal. We have a different purpose. But it is a good thing. Because through that whole, by us living for something other than this world, we draw attention to God and hopefully can build His kingdom. I'd like to see, first of all, a few references where we actually get the phrase strangers and pilgrims. The first one would be in Hebrews 11, at least the first one as it comes in the Bible. There are really only two of these. Yet the idea is much larger. So Hebrews 11, verses 13 through 16 are the verses that I'm going to read. And in the verses leading up to 13, there's a list of several patriarchs. We have Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Sarah, and then in 13, we'll start reading. It says, "These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned." So just noticing something here on the verse 15. The words "be mindful," "if they had been mindful of that country." I think that's saying if they had chose to think about that. Let their minds go back. If they had dwelt on that, they might have had opportunity to have returned. So we don't want to turn back. God is calling us on to something new, and we want to look forward to what He has in whatever change it might be. Some of us, we're going to a new community. Others continue here. But there's always something ahead of us that God has for us. So let's not turn back. Verse 16, but now they desire a better country, that is, in heavenly, wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for He hath prepared for them a city. Find it interesting that some of these peoples, actually most of them, and I didn't dig very deeply, but the people that were mentioned before this point in the chapter, Abel was one. He was contrasted to his brother. He stood out as different. So Cain and Abel, Cain's sacrifices were, I'm not sure if the Bible calls them evil, but was not what God was looking for. Abel, he did what God wanted of him. Enoch, he was said to have walked with God, even when most of society was very sinful. We know the time leading up to the flood there, it was exceedingly sinful. And he stood out as somebody that walked with God. Once again, I don't maybe have the exact years as far as how that was in comparison to the flood, but Noah was soon after there, and he was one of the very few that believed what God said. Abraham and Sarah literally left their homeland to become a pilgrim and a stranger. And I don't know exactly how things were leading up to that, but their life, you know, their lives were different. They were nomadic, but still, it was a great act of faith to do what they did there. The second place where we find this phrase is in 1 Peter. 1 Peter 2. Chapter 2, verses 9 through 12. In these verses, Peter's pointing out that the Christians, as forgiven sinners, are a royal priesthood. There's to be a stark difference between them and the unbelievers of their day and also of our day. In verse 9, it says, but ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, and holy nation, a peculiar people, that ye shall show forth the praises of Him who hath called you out of darkness and into His marvelous light, which in time past were not a people, but are now the people of God, which had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. Referring to them as Gentiles here, being accepted into God's plan of salvation. Dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul, having your conversation honest among the Gentiles, that whereas ye speak against, they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works, which they shall behold, glorify God in the day of visitation. So, strangers and pilgrims, we are to abstain from fleshly lusts. The next phrase there explains why. It says, which they war against your soul. It's something that can grab a hold of us, and we're tied by those things that we allow to grip us and distract us from the way. I want to look at Jesus a little bit as our ultimate example for the pattern of life that He showed us. And while I realize Jesus' life was pretty short, not much longer than mine, actually. And for 30 years, He helped His Father, He helped His family. I think that shows that that he cared about his family. But then we know, as you know, how his ministry developed, and he went on to do what God had put him on the earth to do, and he went through with that. If you could summarize Jesus' life in one sentence, summarize the purpose of his life, and how he carried that out, what would it be? I don't know if anybody's quick at thinking, but if you are and you want to give us a short summary, I'd be happy to hear that. Okay, to do the Father's will and to seek and to save the lost, which is the Father's will. So we can boil it down to just a small, something very simple. Now, if you would think about your own life and summarize your own life and your own purpose, what is it? And how does it line up with Christ's purpose that we hold as our example? I would have a hard time summarizing my life and my purpose in one sentence, because I guess it's because we're human and we're tempted to do so many, try to do so much, and we have so many desires and we have so many opportunities. But can I boil it down to the one thing, and that is to do my Father's will? He cared for his family. He cared for the soul of man. I would say that was his highest, well, in coming to the earth, I think that was the ultimate purpose, was to save man. And that aligned with his Father's desire of having, or redemption. It was all one. And then another thing that I was thinking about, that was that he never let anything of the world distract him from that. You know, he cared about his father, he cared about his mother, and you know, he showed that at his crucifixion. But he didn't let that. He didn't feel so sorry for his mother that he decided he couldn't go through with what God had for him. And it was, he went through with his Father's will. Let's look at 1 Peter 4. Chapter 4, verses 1 through 5. What I'd like to see in here is that he was willing to suffer at the hands of those that didn't understand his purpose. They didn't understand and they didn't accept him. I think if some people would have understood, they would have not treated him as they did. But that he wasn't held back by that. Let's read verse 1. Through 5, it says, "For as much then as Christ hath suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves likewise with the same mind. For he that hath suffered in the flesh hath ceased from sin, that he no longer should live the rest of his time in the flesh to the lust of men, but to the will of God. For the time past of our life may suffice us to have wrought the will of the Gentiles, when we walked in lasciviousness, lust, excess of wine, revelings, banquetings, and abominable idolatries." How many things in there could we insert from our society today? I mean, these do pretty much cover them. They're a little bit harder to understand, maybe, the words. Another part of the Bible speaks of the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. I think would be a similar list there. But the world is used to that. That's the normal. In verse 4 it says, "Wherein they think it strange that ye run not with them to the same excess of riot, speaking evil of you. Who shall give account to him that is ready?" Sorry. "Speaking evil of you, who shall give account to him that is ready to judge the quick and the dead?" So is it okay if people don't understand why we do church plants, why we do outreaches? Now, I know we're in a fairly Christian community. It's not that uncommon. My neighbor, actually, just told me the other day that his son, Rennie Holder's son, was a pastor at a local church. And he told the church one day that he's doing a church plant. And so it's a little different way of doing that. But still, and, you know, that's how they do it. We'll let that with them. But so a lot of people will understand, you know, maybe what we're going through. And even just as we do Christian things, as we return good for evil, as we do things that are not normal, it's okay. They don't have to understand that. God understands. And we do. We can take losses cheerfully because of what we know, that God is on our side. One more thing. Jesus is the author and he's the finisher of our faith. In Hebrews 12:2, you don't have to look this up. It says, "Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God." So I would like to especially emphasize what Jesus went through at the cross. He endured the cross. He despised the shame. So he did not let the shame of the cross detour him and make him give in to the devil. Because there was certain shame that went with that, for sure. Yet, it says he saw. There was something that was set before him, and he saw that, and the joy that he was to have at the Father's side, and that's what drew him past all that. That's what drew him through that, and he's now sat down at the right hand of God. I thought I would go over just a few characteristics. There's lots of characteristics that belong in the pilgrim's life, but I'll just give a few. In John 17, it talks about being in but not of. John 17, we'll read verses 15 through 18. There would have been more verses in this chapter. I didn't feel like I could use them all. So these are the verses that most clearly give this. "I pray not," in verse 15, "that thou shouldest take them out of the world, but that thou shouldest keep them from the evil. They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. Sanctify them through thy truth. Thy word is truth." Jesus was praying here for the people, for his followers, not just for the personal ones in his day, but for the ones coming after. And 18 it says, "As thou hast sent me into the world, so also have I sent them into the world." And he's praying for them, not that God would take us out of the world, because then, you know, if God would just take his people out of the world right now, there would be hundreds and thousands of souls that would not have the light of Christ. It would never reach them. So he's chosen to leave us in the world that we can shine that light and that people can be added to his kingdom. But Jesus did ask for God to protect, to keep. And that is a promise that we have, that Christ will always protect and keep his people. Another characteristic of the pilgrim is that he lives knowing that the world is not his home. This one is probably the most challenging to me. Us as humans, we really can get distracted by this world, by this life. Satan tries to make us believe that we need a little bit of everything. We need lots of possessions. We need this, we need that. And you know, they might not be wrong, some of them. But along with those things come so many distractions and a vicious work cycle. I thought I would give you an example. I don't know, might be a weak example. So we bought a place in Searcy, and we hope to live in that house someday. So I'm gonna compare that to my future home. We know it's an earthly home, right? But it needs a lot of work. And what if in that process of getting that place fixed up and we want to end up there, right? I think it'll work well for us. But we can't live in it right away. It's probably very bad shape. And so we're going to have to do some work to it. What if I would go to my neighbor and I decided to say I'd go to my neighbor, because what happens in life here, in our transitional life, cannot go with us beyond the grave. So let's just say that I go to the neighbor and he has a beautiful spot out in his pasture. And it's got some nice shade trees there, and it's on a hill, and you can see way out, you see. And I decide I'm going to set a camper up there and I can live there for the time being until my house is ready. But along with that comes so many other things that I have to make sure happens. There's no water there. There's no electricity. It needs a lot, just a lot of work to get it there. Pretty soon, I spend all of what I have saved up to finish my house out with. I spend all that on just the things that I need to even be there temporarily. And it's not even going to be mine once I move on. We're leaving it there for the neighbor. So I think, well, maybe I'll use my old camper. But after all, it's kind of small, and I think that's going to be too stressful for my family, so I'm going to go buy me a nice big one. And I spend my last dime on my camper. But the neighbor, he did say that I could probably use it if I would go buy a nice one and leave it there. I could use it whenever I wanted to. So it has certain benefits on down the road. But I get to the day that I have to be off of his property and my house isn't even touched. But I really lived it up while I was on his property. We enjoyed ourselves. We sat under the shade trees and we watched the sunsets. And we enjoyed the nice weather and being out in nature. But as we got to the end of our stay there, we had nothing more than that. And we found out that we had absolutely nothing once we left. So when you get to eternity, what will you have? I think I'd have been better off to save, to invest some of the time, some of the money that I put into that little oasis in the pasture. I'd have been better off to take that and just live with the necessities of life, put what I needed to in my house, and prepare for the future. We so easily do that with our life on earth. We look at the now. We look at what would be nice to have, what would, you know, whether it's our time or is it our friendships, our relationships. We don't invest in the future. So we need to live knowing that this world is just temporary. We need to live with that in mind. And we have to see that goal of being with Jesus after death, because that's really what matters. We'll be careful to choose godly friends. We'll be careful to, and not only will we be careful with that, but we will put effort into taking people with us. Because we can also, you know, our eyes have been opened. We can see what's going to happen to the sinner, but you know what? They might not see it. They might not even know what's going to happen to them. Yet we as Christians can see that, what's going to happen to them. Let's help to open their eyes. So are you, am I, a pilgrim and a stranger? So let's be careful when we ask that question. Let's ask it about ourselves. Let's not ask it about whoever else. I'm not saying that that doesn't have its place. But we do need to be careful because God has called everyone to a different walk, at least to a certain degree. We're all at a different place in our journey. So let's always be mindful of that. You know, me personally, am I open to having God direct my path somewhere way down south? Or somewhere that I would have not envisioned myself going? The next question is, do I love the world? We have some verses on this. In 1 John, it talks about loving the world. Let's go to 1 John chapter 2. Chapter 2, verses 15 through 17. Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world passeth away, and the lust thereof, but he that doeth the will of God abideth forever. No room. No room for God. We let the world get into our hearts and fill it up, and it will. We open the door to the world. It doesn't take a big opening, just a little crack, and it'll fill up very quickly. And when there's world in my heart, the Lord can't fit. So what is it that crowds God out? In very practical ways, what is it that keeps you from spending time alone with God? I need to slow down. There's so many things, so many other things. I don't know, you know, your personal situation, but we need to slow down and just listen to God. Spend time with God. That's one thing that can push God out, is just the busyness. And let's go to another reference here. I have Romans 12. Romans 12, verse 2. Just one verse here. I'll read it. And be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that ye may prove that which is good and acceptable and perfect will of God. I read that wrong. That ye may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. We grow to be like those that we look up to. I don't know if you've noticed, think back in your history. I can think back in mine, and I can think of a person or two that moved into my community, and it changed the speech of many others. I don't know. Certain people have that, I guess we'll call it, an ability. So have you noticed a person with a different accent that comes in, and pretty soon there's somebody else that kind of talks like him, at least when you're talking about them? But it's kind of interesting how I've noticed it, I think, in maybe two different communities where, I won't say any names, but they kind of take on the accent or the way of talking of a person that has moved in. And we don't do that purposely. That's how subtle the devil is with making us to conform to the world. That's what we call conforming to. And when we start to speak or to think or to act in what we buy and what we how we treat our customers, how we try to, the world will affect our way of doing that if we're not careful. And that's what it's talking about here when it says, be not conformed, but we should be transformed by a renewed mind. James 4, verse 4, says, ye adulterers and adulteresses, know ye not that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever will be a friend to the world is the enemy of God. Pretty bold language. We don't have a lot to guess about that verse. So friendship of the world, I guess we could speculate on what that means. To be a friend to the world. Or maybe to break it down further, to agree with the world or to not resist but embrace the things that come out of the world. The lines start to get a little foggy, and you know, how we should relate to those around us, how we should, But let's just step back and take a look at what we do and why we do them. What drives us? What are our motives for doing these things? Is it pride, which is so prevalent in the world today? Pride has just taken over. The world is in our hearts at times. So, in closing, if you've been distracted, what are some things that you can do to not be distracted or to regain that focus on Christ, on eternity with Him? How can we do that? You've probably got tricks in your pocket on that. You've probably experienced that. I say tricks in your pocket. You've probably at least, you know, dealt with that sometime or another, and maybe the Lord has showed you how to overcome that. I wish I knew all of those ways, because it's tricky sometimes. We are drawn into that stuff so naturally, and we don't even recognize it. Sometimes it's just best just to ask your friends and to tell your friends to be honest with you and tell you how the world is creeping into your heart. It's pretty natural for us to see everybody else's issues. And I guess we'll use that in a positive way in this case, because if we cash into other people seeing our issues, we should be able to learn from them, right? But it is true that sometimes we don't see our problems, whether small or big, like other people see them. So let's rely on each other, on our brothers and sisters, to expose some of those things in our lives. And last, I want to just step back and view Maybe just imagine a little bit. So what does it look like to God as he's in heaven and he sees the earth, and on this earth we have thousands and thousands of beings, of people. So we've got the earth, and it's just a hubbub of activity. Looks like a bunch of little ants. And there's no direction. Until the cross comes into view. And the cross has affected a lot of people's hearts. It's renewed a lot of people's hearts. But there's still just the world as a whole is lost. They have no view of anything beyond the earth. All they can see is the sin. All they can see is the excitement of living. And they're just so enthralled with that that they're blind. That the devil has blinded their eyes to what they could be living for. And then the cross has changed some people. And so we have a small core of people that are looking to God as their Savior. He saved them, and their eyes have been opened. They now see eternity. And that's their goal. So they are looking, they're looking up, they're looking past the things of the earth. Without that, all they would see is sin, what they can get for themselves. That's all they'd see. But now we have a new vision. We can look up to God. And as they look at God, he leads them through different places. Some in the United States. Some he leads through Africa. Some leads somebody through Asia and many other countries. And this group that is has a goal, has eternity in their focus, is helping others to find that. We're finding blind people as we go, and we point them to the cross. We have to look higher, and someday we'll all be together in heaven again, and hopefully we'll have something to show for it, for our life here on earth, for our all the struggles that we faced. And we can all be together at God's throne. That is all I have today. Let's stand for prayer.